Hello, and welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, where we explore how the health of our planet affects the health of the people on it, and how we, as healthcare professionals, have the power to lead the way in curbing the climate crisis and to be pioneers in building sustainable healthcare systems. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Ashling, a junior doctor and member of the EcoMedics team, and we have an incredible lineup of guests who will be joining me on each episode to share their experience and expertise about health and the environment. On this podcast episode, we welcome Richard Hickson. Richard is a consultant in anaesthetics and critical care in Durham, where he also co-chairs the hospital's Sustainability Development Group. He is on the member board of trustees for the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare, an organisation rallying health professionals and patients to reduce the industry's carbon footprint. His particular area of environmental interest is in advocating for the protection of oceans, coasts and inland waterways. In 2020, Richard co-founded Healthcare Ocean, an organisation fighting to include oceanic health in the discussion around healthcare sustainability. Healthcare Ocean focuses on educating about the link between human health and oceanic health, the need to conserve blue spaces and minimising harm to the oceans through procurement within the NHS. A huge welcome to the podcast, Richard. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Ashling. Very well, thank you. And thanks for having me.
I'm honoured to be able to talk to you today to find out more about some of these exciting projects that you're involved in, and I'm certain that we'll all learn a great deal around areas that maybe don't get as much coverage. So to start, please tell us about Healthcare Ocean.
Well, Healthcare Ocean came about in, or was officially formed in October 2020, and the pathway to its formation was rather organic. It was simply down to the fact that when I moved into sustainability from other kind of hospital posts, like being a deputy medical director, where I wasn't seeing environmentally focused actions within the trust. When I moved into sustainability and I started reading all about the challenges we face and the potential solutions, what I wasn't reading was about oceanic health, or more worryingly, the deterioration, the degradation that our oceans were facing. And it's just an area that I just had an amateur interest in. I mean, all my life, I have absolutely loved marine life. My favourite marine mammal when I was growing up was the Yangtze River dolphin. I wanted to be a marine biologist. I ticked the wrong box on my UCA form and ended up a medic. So, it just kept on, alarm bells kept on ringing. And I just kept on putting my hands up in every meeting and saying to people, what about oceanic health? We're not talking about oceans here. You know, this is really important. And everybody looked at me very, very blankly until one day a GP from Northumbria, Georgie Soman, contacted me after one of these meetings. It was an integrated care system meeting and said, you mentioned oceans. Nobody ever mentions oceans. that's what I'm concerned about. And Healthcare Ocean was born.
And the three areas that are mentioned on the website are oceans, coasts and waterways. Would you mind giving us an overview of the three different bodies of water mentioned there?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it just recognises that everything's connected. We talk about green spaces, but green spaces interface with blue spaces, predominantly at the coast, but also at inland waterways. So, for example, why is it important? 80% of oceanic pollution arises on land. How to get to the ocean through inland waterways, through to the coast and into the ocean. So that's a very simple example of why the three are important and linked. Pharmaceutical production in distant countries, discharges go into inland waterways, through the coast, into the oceans. Our own pharmaceutical residues go down our toilets, follow the same pathway. And not just that, but when inland waterways and coasts especially are healthy and clean, there is massive benefit to human health and well-being, especially for individuals who have the lowest access to resources. And those who have the least can benefit the most from access to healthy inland waterways and coasts.
It's really interesting that you've you say about the fact that oceans aren't really talked about as much. And I think the recent documentary Seaspiracy can be credited for opening many people's eyes to some of the issues of our oceans. But I think apart from this, our blue spaces don't seem to get much attention, as you said. What is it that draws you in particular to advocating for our oceans?
Well, I mean, just going back to your point about the coverage there, I mean, less than 5% of coverage on sustainability issues is oceanic, and the 95% is on land and air. And that's because we're a land-based species. We breathe air every day. Not many people see the oceans, and certainly fewer see below the oceans on a daily basis. What focused my mind was understanding that if we ignore oceanic health and degradation, it will soon overtake carbon as our main threat to our health and well-being. And that is what focuses my mind. We have a very, very, we simplify everything to fossil fuel emissions, CO2 in the atmosphere, and global warming. That is all extremely important. But if we don't bring oceanic health into our conversations on a level playing field with land and atmosphere, we will simply fail. We will see net zero disappear over the horizon the closer we get. And so therefore, we knew we needed to give oceans a voice, and we needed to wake up our national leaders to this critical part of the biosphere and get this on the agenda discussed and part of our action plans.
Do you mind telling us a bit about why there is so much threat to the ocean with a lack of sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at what oceans give us, you know, they give us food, they give us medicines, they give us health, they give us transportation, they keep us warm in the UK. I mean, if you look at the latitude that we sit on, or Newcastle sits on, it sits on the same latitude as a place in Alaska called Cold Bay, which is about 20 degrees colder. But the UK is kept warm by the oceans. You know, this is everything that we, all the positives in our lives are absolutely driven by the oceans. And yet what we give them back is a whole stack of negatives. So, for example, at least 25% of our carbon dioxide heads into the oceans. And when photosynthetic capacity is overwhelmed, so these are the tiny photosynthesizing Prochlorococcus, diatoms, coccolithophores. When they cannot photosynthesize because there isn't the biomass in the photic zone to do so, then the CO2 is absorbed by the oceans.
What do you mean the biomass? What are you referring to there?
Well, over 60% of oceanic biomass. So this is literally it's the organic mass within the oceans. Over 60% is less than 1 millimeter in diameter. So most of the oceanic biomass is tiny, tiny organisms called phytoplankton. They are photosynthesizing microcellular organisms, and they essentially photosynthesize in the photic zone, and then they are eaten by slightly larger phytoplankton called zooplankton, which feed on the phytoplankton, feed on each other, and these form the basis of the entire marine food chain. But whilst they are photosynthesizing, they are capturing CO2 from the atmosphere, and every single night, all these small crustaceans called copepods, followed by fish and squid and everything else, they migrate up from the mesopelagic zone about 300 meters down, and they feed upon these photosynthesizing organisms, capturing the carbon that these organisms have captured themselves. And then before morning, they descend back into the mesopelagic zone, taking the carbon with them. And this biomass in the oceans has decreased by 50% in 70 years. And as a result, the oceans are becoming less effective at photosynthesizing.
Drawing in that carbon from the atmosphere that we're pumping out.
Absolutely. And therefore, the CO2 simply goes into the oceans themselves, not being photosynthesized. This acidifies the oceans, and acidic oceans, they hold less CO2, they hold less oxygen. They obviously start affecting carbonate-based species, which then literally start dissolving. And when we look at the trajectory of oceanic acidification, We've dropped, the pH has dropped by about 0.1 units in 150 years. That equates to a 26% rise in hydrogen ion concentration. So it's risen by a quarter.
Wow.
That, and that acidification rate is 10 times the speed of the epoch preceding the end Permian extinction 250 million years ago. And to put the risk in perspective, the end Permian extinction saw the loss of 96% of marine biomass and species. And we are heading in that direction 10 times quicker than that extinction event.
Gosh, I feel that you've really explained that so clearly, because it's not something that I think is that well known, and it's fairly complex. But actually, what you're saying essentially is our oceans have a huge responsibility in keeping the homeostasis of our planet by enabling, you know, the carbon to be absorbed, which we desperately need at the moment as one way of offsetting the immense amount of carbon that's going into the atmosphere. And apart from that, all of the species that are within the oceans that, as you said, have huge benefit in so many ways for us are at risk if we're not catching on to this sooner.
I think, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, Aisling, is very simply, if we hadn't have lost 50% of oceanic biomass since 1950, and this period has a very, you know, a nice name, it's called the Great Acceleration since 1950, and I can talk about that more if you wish. But if it, we hadn't lost 50% of biomass, then maybe the 2 gigatons of carbon, not CO2 carbon, that the oceans absorb every year, maybe that would be 4 gigatons. Maybe the 4 gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere every year would be 2 gigatons. Maybe global warming wouldn't be happening at such a rate. Now, this is all speculative.
Mm.
But to me, if you've lost 50% of photosynthesizing biomass, then actually, you know, okay, you know, the numbers are probably, you know, I'm probably oversimplifying, but we might not be in the situation that we're in right now. And I'm not the only one to believe this, that actually global warming has been driven as much by the loss of the oceanic biomass as it has by the CO2 emissions into the atmosphere.
Do you have hope that we'll be able to change the landscape of where we're heading in terms of global warming?
I think, Aisling, if the only way I will truly have hope is if we have healthy oceans. And to put that in perspective, land-based biomass doubles every 60 years, 50, 60 years, if you allow it to. So you imagine the timescale it will require to plant trees, for those trees to mature, for the soils to become healthy and sequester carbon. It is beyond the lifeline that we've got to deliver change. Oceanic biomass, it doubles every 3 days in healthy oceans, all down to these tiny, tiny microscopic phytoplankton. There's 1 gigaton that exists in the ocean at any one time, and that turns over every 8.5 days. All the time it's capturing CO2. If we create oceans that are healthy, non-acidic, less warm, not as hypoxic, have quieter, cleaner ships traveling on them and less molecular pollution, the oceans will actually offer us the lifeline that humanity needs to survive. I mean, we came from the oceans to begin with. They gave us life. And if we treat them well from now on, they may give us a second chance of life in the future.
And actually, that just fills me with so much hope, because I think the information, the awareness is starting to get out there about what's happening to the planet, and the urgency of it is really terrifying. I think people can feel really maybe quite bound by that and quite helpless. So it's really exciting, actually, that although it's a terrifying outlook, there is hope in that places like the ocean could be our sanctity in actually making huge change. It's amazing to hear that about the, you know, about the biomass doubling every 3 days. It just shows that there is a way to move forward. We just need to act on it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I repeatedly say to organisations, if you do not have a blue plan within your green plan, rewrite it, because it's not fit for purpose and it won't solve the problem.
What do you see to be some of the biggest threats to our oceans right now?
In one word, pollution. it is, we see macro pollution, you know. I mean, let's face it, the NHS itself produces 600,000 tons of waste every year, and that's a fraction of the world's global waste. So we see all this macro pollution going into the ocean, and we all kind of we gasp when we see the great Pacific garbage patch and our beaches, and obviously some of these coastal regions in developing countries. But when we look beneath the surface, we find what we call molecular pollution. And this is what we don't see. And this is where it gets incredibly scary, because the macro pollution, there's quite a few plans afoot to try and clean these up. There's a lot of initiatives globally to look at inland waterways and existing pollution within the oceans to try and remove it. They're very ambitious. They may or may not succeed. But when it comes to molecular pollution, this is what is killing our oceans. For example, microplastics come from macroplastics. Most plastics are forever. Once they get into the oceans, they keep breaking down, breaking down, breaking down until they become tiny, tiny little molecules. These molecules attract other molecules, what we call forever chemicals. And since 1950, there's been something like 350,000 chemicals authorized for use, very few of which have undergone a robust environmental assessment. And these chemicals, we use them in our daily lives, things like PFAS, which is found on coatings on saucepans as flame retardants and water repellents on all sorts of products. But these are forever toxic. They get into the oceans, they're hydrophilic, so they bind to all these microplastics. And then these are taken up by our small phytoplankton, and it kills them. The dust produced off tyres and brake pads finds its way into the atmosphere and then finds its way through our drains into the oceans. Again, this has this kind of binding property for these nasty forever chemicals that then kill our phytoplankton, reducing the photosynthetic capacity. If we think about our pharmaceuticals, the manufacture and the use of pharmaceuticals, where they're manufactured, they poison inland waterways because of poor water treatment. Where they're used, they find their way down our toilets as metabolites when we excrete them, or through urine bags on critical care where I work, down through sluices. These are not removed by our wastewater facilities. They end up in the oceans, and these two can cause all sorts of problems. So when we think about oceans, we're turning them into a toxic soup of molecular pollution binding to microplastics, destroying the microscopic level of the oceans, which is reducing photosynthetic capacity.
And what are some of the ways in which Healthcare Ocean are working to prevent these changes?
Well, number one, and the biggest, is educating. So last year, we started talking about this. We started very small, and we ended up at COP26. So I was lucky to speak at COP26 four times over the 2 weeks. And what we were basically, the narrative we were using was that as a healthcare system, we understand how healthcare can be put under threat. So I draw comparisons with COVID that was going on at the same time that we formed Healthcare Ocean. COVID, one virus, it brought healthcare to its knees. Climate change, God knows how many viruses, bacteria, protozoa we're going to find that we're dealing with. Heat-related illness, trauma from flooding, from adverse weather events, mental health problems, malnutrition, war, all these sorts of things. We haven't got a hope in keeping people healthy through climate change. And we know that because COVID almost broke us. And that was one virus. So the way that we're articulating this, we're basically saying that as a healthcare system, as we progress, if we do not improve the health of our oceans and improve the health of our biosphere, we cannot keep you healthy. So that's the narrative that we are using within our education. And that's the narrative that I use with the shipping industry at COP26. And the good thing is that it seems to resonate because most people do care about their health and well-being. So education is the very much the kind of how we've approached this so far.
And what kind of ways are you tackling that?
Well, we tackle it through two threads. One is through the supplier-provider axis of healthcare. So we have big industries involved in healthcare, big healthcare itself. It's worth trillions globally. Container shipping, it's worth trillions globally. We're an island nation. Everything comes into the NHS, pretty much 80% of the goods on container ships. Container ships are used by our suppliers to the NHS. There's 80,000 of them. So 80,000 suppliers use container ships that sail on oceans and deliver goods to our healthcare system. So what we've done is we've reached out to the container shipping industry and through trade bodies and directly and through NHS England to our suppliers, and we are explaining this. So we are saying to our suppliers, you have to get to grips with your manufacturing from the perspective of what harm you're doing to inland waterways. You have to get to grips with your shipping methods, because not all ships are created equally. There are good ships and bad ships. They are, I would like to mention, they are the lifeline of human healthcare. We can't do without them. There is nothing as environmentally sustainable as shipping to deliver goods to the UK. So we have to work with them to make them understand that in delivering healthcare goods to the UK, they are causing harm to the oceans themselves through their emissions, through their noise, through their marine mammal collision, through transfer of non-invasive species, all these kind of shipping negatives. And we have to get these huge industries to embrace the fact that everything they do is causing harm to the oceans. But what they are also doing is delivering our healthcare goods that also causes harm to the ecosystem and our oceans. So there's this huge narrative that involves industry and private public sector collaboration to address container shipping and molecular pollution, which are two of the main work streams that we focus on.
It's incredible, because as you said, that as a healthcare service, we need these shipments, we need the products that are being delivered. So it's really important that we are using our purchasing power, because we're such a huge influence as the NHS, because we buy so much, that we are holding these companies to account and trying to basically say to them, if you don't sort yourself out, we might have to rethink things, and we have the power to do that. So it's amazing that that's the work that you're doing.
Well, we have to be really careful with the narrative as well, Aisling, because what we have here is none of us have lived through a mass extinction event, which is what we're living through at the moment. So this is new territory for everyone. So we are very much at Healthcare Ocean, we're sector agnostic. So we are as much supplier as we are provider. We span that gulf between the two, and we talk to absolutely everybody. And what we've discovered is suppliers want to change. They actually do. They are crying out for support to change. And the shipping industry knows it has to change and is making immense steps, you know. But again, it's kind of like, how do you show the shipping industry that you want to support them? Well, what you do is you do that through your supplier engagement, and you get the suppliers to say to their freight forwarders and their carriers, you know, look, guys, you know, we want to use clean, quiet, considerate shipping to get our goods to the NHS. What we then do is we work with NHS England through their social value guidance and their evergreen supplier framework to say, how can we pitch this? How can we nudge our suppliers to ask these questions, to make the changes? So we like to see this as a collaboration rather than a directive, because even though it is a directive through policy procurement note 620 from the UK government, our suppliers have to do this. It's unfair to kind of cut them loose and say, do this or else. We like to kind of put our arms around both and just say, look, guys, let's work on this together, because, you know, we should all be facing in the same direction here. And that direction is to improve planetary health.
Nowadays, when we think of danger to our oceans, it's hard not to think about plastic and the terrifying amount of plastic that we're using. And as you said, is polluting our oceans. In the NHS, we do use an astounding amount of single-use plastics. What is your thoughts on this? And is there a way that we can reduce this? Is that something that Healthcare Ocean focuses on, or is it mainly the delivery of these products?
No, it's we do drift into this area as well, because it's absolutely essential. Circular economy is enormously important. You know, I mean, in the simplest term, we need to reduce the amount of stuff we bring in. We need to keep the stuff in that comes in, and then we must stop it leaving, you know, because the leaving is waste and the bringing in is harm, and manufacturing is associated with harm. And there will always be some harm. So circular economy and keeping stuff within the system is absolutely essential. This is something that we completely support, embrace, and totally understand that it needs to be ramped up to a level, you know, perhaps even preceding, you know, those good old days of reusable equipments and reusable equipment that I grew up with. When we do need to bring goods in, and when we do need single-use items, and there will always be a need, then we need to really look at the science behind this, and we need to be absolutely action-focused. So, for example, huge amounts of plastic, but 2/3 of this in the NHS is packaging. So here's an opportunity. Number one, reduction in the packaging. So we can use our social value guidance to really nudge our manufacturers into using less packaging, more efficient packaging. But also, because packaging is not the medical device, there is therefore options within industry to turn this into something different. For example, if you look at the biodegradable plastic chemistry, polyhydroxyalkanoates, which are produced by bacteria, these can be used to create biodegradable plastic packaging that doesn't need to be incinerated. It's not contaminated by clinical waste, by blood and other bodily fluids. So it can be disposed of in a different way. So if we can create a biodegradable packaging that does not need to be incinerated, that does effectively biodegrade in the environment, we reduce 2/3 of our plastic waste immediately. And if that is an entry level to supply healthcare goods into the NHS, so that is an absolute barrier to supply, then you could drive massive changes at that kind of national level.
To what extent does eating fish and seafood contribute to the contamination or threat to our ocean?
Back to Seaspiracy, aren't we? Seaspiracy, I think it was great that it elevated the topic. It has been critiqued and it is journalism, so we do have to be a little bit cautious here. Seafood is the primary protein for billions, and it should be the primary protein for many more who can't afford to eat their own catch because they sell it to buy grains. If we create a healthy oceanic ecosystem, then fish is a very, very important long-term protein source for billions around the world. And the one great thing about oceans is they do bounce back quicker than land. So when you improve your primary oceanic production, your small organisms, then everything follows, okay, within a biodiverse, balanced ecosystem. And so I think fish is very important as a future food substrate. And I just think we need to be fishing in a sustainable way in a healthy ocean.
And I suppose all of those things that you're talking about, shipping, can also be transferred to the fishing industry in a way of doing it more sustainably as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, big factory trawlers and ships which breach, you know, international boundaries to fish in areas that are perhaps a little better stocked because they've depleted their own local catch. I don't think there's going to be any place in future for any of these ships. I mean, when it comes to trawling, you get massive physical damage to ecosystems and obviously lots of bycatch. And this is unacceptable. You know, we lose hundreds of millions of sharks every single year to bycatch and for shark's fin soup. I think it's something like less than 10 humans a year to sharks. You know, they really are the victims. And, you know, we've got to stop those practices which upset the finely balanced ecosystem, which is the oceans.
I'm not sure if this is something that is on your radar or is something that you explore with Healthcare Ocean, but there's a very real threat of running out of fresh water, which came as quite a shock to me when I first learned about it. And I think it's a very underappreciated consequence that many don't recognise, because there is this false sense of abundance, given that over 70% of the Earth's surface is water. So how could we possibly run out? But of course, only a small percentage of that water is drinkable. And even a tinier percentage of that is even accessible to us because it's trapped in ice caps, in glaciers, or deep below the Earth's surface. So really, all of the water we need to drink, water crops, feed animals, is a very finite amount. Is this something that comes into the picture when you're looking into our waterways?
It's something that we're very much aware of. I mean, more from the global perspective, as in, you know, as global warming progresses and glacial runoff decreases, then that affects the freshwater supplies to some extremely vulnerable populations. We don't specifically focus on it as a topic to pursue within Healthcare Ocean, because we're fairly thinly spread as it is with the existing work streams. But we do know that it is a very real risk.
EcoMedics is a non-profit organisation run by volunteer healthcare professionals alongside their clinical roles treating patients. In each episode, we include a short message from our generous sponsors, which allows us to keep doing what we do while also promoting other change-making organisations. If you'd be interested in sponsoring an episode, please get in touch by emailing hello@ecomedics.co.uk. I just want to ask a little bit now about your work locally within your own hospital, because you're heavily involved in the sustainability programme there. I'd love to hear about the work you're doing within your trust towards sustainability.
Yeah, that's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, but very much linked and no less important. I mean, like all trusts, we woke up to this a few years ago, or started waking up to this a few years ago. I mean, when I started in this route, I remember putting my hand up in a meeting and saying, you know, what's the trust's carbon output? What are we going to do with it? And everyone looked at me very blankly, as if, you know, why do we need to be worried about this question? We've progressed massively. You know, the chief executive, Sue Jakes, has been incredibly supportive. And our sustainability development group now is really forging ahead. We're very much aligned to net zero. The NHS England document published in October 2020. So we tick all the usual boxes of having the net zero board level lead and focusing on all these big carbon areas like estates and facilities, travel and transport. You know, we start measuring our estates and facilities output. We know we've decreased our carbon footprint within ENF by 40% in 13 years. We've got an incredibly active kind of waste management program and a really inspirational waste manager, Sam Goss. And we're really getting to grips with waste and pollution, mainly because, you know, that ongoing driver that I have of wanting to know where everything ends up. Travel and transport, obviously another huge topic, 10 billion road miles a year with the NHS. So immense focus on that, but also trying to when we're looking locally, trying to bring in some of the national work into that. So, you know, within the oceanic work, you know, we know that, you know, tire and brake dust from vehicles is a massive pollutant of air and oceans. So we very much educate people that just because you buy a heavy Jaguar I-Pace or a Tesla or a Porsche that's electric, you're not saving the planet, because your tire and brake dust is going down the drains and poisoning the ocean. So actually what you should be doing is traveling less, full stop, using a push bike or e-bike whenever possible. And, you know, active transport is always preferable to every other modality of transport, and use trains when obviously traveling around the country. So we're trying to bring some of the national work into the local narrative as well. What we have done is, I think we're one of the first trusts in the country to make the e-learning for health module, the CSH Health Education England module, a required competency in the trust. So within 4 or 5 months, we actually went up to 75% completion of trust staff. So that's about 6,000 members of staff completing the module in just 4 months. So I don't believe any other trust has gone down that route as of yet. But I think hopefully as an exemplar, we can show that we can reach out and educate people in sustainability as long as you have a really, really strong trust backing in order to take that step.
And what kind of, I guess, action points are in that training, or what would you recommend that staff be doing apart from what you mentioned there about, you know, reducing car use? What can they be doing at work and around work to be reducing their carbon footprint?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, everything's it's no rocket science, you know, with respect to reducing your carbon footprint. You know, it's everything you think it is. You know, it is operational TLC, you know, turn off equipment, lights off, control temperatures, insulate your building, stop energy loss, reduce the energy consumption. Look at your theatres, you know, look at your scavenging systems. How often are they on when there is no patient in theatre? You know, it is all very, very simple, reducing energy consumption. It is then you reducing consumption, full stop. We need to be less of a consumer, and we need to be, as I said, embracing circular economies of equipment. So if you're throwing anything in the bin, then question whether or not that has to be a single use item, you know, and we have to completely turn the clock back on our hospital-based systems in order to recreate the circular economies that we need to move forward. So there's absolutely no rocket science here, Aisling. You know, you read NHS Net Zero, you follow the guidance, it's all there, and every single hospital in the country should be doing exactly this. And a lot of what is mentioned in Net Zero is equally transferable to your home environment.
I really hear what you're saying there about things like energy use, which seems crazily huge in the NHS, that there's always computers on, lights on, just nothing ever turns off. Mm. I absolutely notice that every day when I'm at work, that there's things on that don't need to be on, or so many ways that we can reduce our energy consumption. I wonder whether something that you're looking into within your trust is where the energy is coming from and the energy supplier of the hospital.
Yeah, we've gone over to renewable energy sources. We've got to be very cautious though about what this means. And again, this is kind of bringing in the global perspective into this. I think globally we run on about 30% renewables or something if you take all sources. And if that's the case, then just switching to renewables, it doesn't mean you're saving the planet, because basically if you take 1% for healthcare out of that 30%, and someone else loses the access to the renewables. Until we are on 100% renewables, this is a little bit of false reassurance. So what I would say is, from an estates and facilities perspective, and this is where hospitals as anchor institutions need to work with their local authorities and their integrated care systems, they need to be looking at new renewables. So not stealing from the renewable grid, but planning with their local authorities where they're going to put their huge solar banks to contribute to the renewable energy grid, you know, or can they put wind turbines on their land, etc. You know, so there's got to be a move away from this false reassurance of using old renewables. And we've got to be working region-wide across integrated care systems for these big scale solutions.
So I know there's a couple of energy companies that purely use renewables, but are they still feeding out of that same small pool of renewables that we have?
Yes.
Is that, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily creating new renewables.
There are more renewables coming onto the market. And there is obviously this theory of demand pull, that the more people who demand renewables, the more the energy companies will create renewables. But I think we just have to look at the current kind of situation with Ukraine and Russia. Suddenly that will go out the window, and you know, we will start looking at how, or countries will start looking how to resurrect their fossil fuel fired energy generation plants, because they get desperate and they look at the immediate consumption required, and renewables take time to build. So the renewable stock will increase in time. Will it increase in time to solve the problem? We can only do that through demand pull and through our own intervention of actually saying, well, do you know what? We're going to team up as a region and we're going to figure out how to supply our hospitals with new renewables. We need that kind of large-scale vision. We don't have many years left. So that's certainly what I drive at regional level. As a narrative, not as an action yet.
I often notice that change can be difficult to bring about in the NHS, firstly because of how independently each trust works. Sometimes even hospitals within the same trust can work vastly differently. And then the turnover of staff can often be high, so changes made don't always stay over time. I imagine having a sustainability group really helps that, but how do you overcome this?
It's got to be everybody's business. It's got to be part of everybody's daily life. You know, we accept certain things, don't we, within our own daily lives, that we do as routine, that we do as, you know, every day. We brush our teeth, we get dressed, we take a breath in. I think we need sustainability to be as automated as that within our daily lives.
Like a habitual process.
Absolutely. And in a hospital, it needs to be so obvious. So everywhere, you can't get away from it. It is absolutely embedded in culture that it's not seen as a separate topic. You don't have a sustainability development group because everybody is focused on sustainability.
And how would staff in the NHS find out about their sustainability or green team, and how would they get involved if they wanted to?
Yeah, well, it's a very, very good question, because we've struggled with this one ourselves. Climate literacy is pretty poor still within the NHS. I think there was a recent Health Foundation survey published where I think only a quarter, 25% of NHS staff understood the net zero ambition. And let's face it, we are streets ahead of many industries, and we're streets ahead of many healthcare systems. So that was quite a worrying figure, considering the airtime Greener NHS has. And it's no fault of Greener NHS. They're doing an incredible job. It's just, as you say, there are massive barriers in the way that we communicate and reach 1.4 million people. So I would say that any sustainability development group has to be linked in very closely with a green staff or blue staff network. So you need a network of people within the trust who are advocates, who just are taking that step further than other people within the trust, who become the voices for the trust to convert every single person into sustainability champions. You need that mass effect. It needs to be 1.4 million voices, 1.4 million educated people who become 1.4 million educators for all the patients that they speak to on a daily basis.
So is it a case of, if you're interested, reaching out and trying to find out about that group?
Yeah, you should. Every trust has to have a net zero, a board level net zero lead.
I didn't realise that, actually.
So that's part of NHS net zero. And I believe that most trusts do have a board level net zero lead. So that's always a good place to start. We know that trusts are at different stages of their journeys. If you look at Newcastle Hospitals, you know, unbelievable team. Just, you know, I mean, as someone within that region, we only aspire to be have a fraction of their success. But, you know, James Dixon, who's led that, is just incredible. And he's 12 years ahead of most other people. So, you know, if you're in Newcastle, it's a doddle. If you're in another hospital that's early on this journey, it can be really difficult. And we do speak to quite a lot of people in hospitals where they say, well, actually, you know, our green plans are really nascent. They're really early days. I'm not really sure who to speak to. So I would go straight to the top. I would go to the chief executive, whose responsibility it is to actually have this plan in place. I would go to the chief executive and say, who's our net zero board level net zero lead? Where's the sustainability development group? I want to be involved.
Brilliant. Thank you. On a slightly separate note, but very much linked, it's really exciting that the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare exists and appears to be growing in its efforts to move towards sustainability in healthcare. This is an organisation that you're involved in. Could you please tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, incredible group of people. They're up there on the pedestal along with Newcastle, you know, with respects to their sustainability work. They have a very strong vision. They're a charity. Rachel Stancliffe, and Francis Mortimer have run it really, and Inge, who have run it virtually since day one, have done immense amounts to educate the healthcare system on all aspects of sustainability, including carbon footprinting and sustainable quality improvement. I mean, they are as high profile as Greener NHS. That's my personal opinion. I see them as much as I go through sustainability literature online or whatever, or as I do the kind of national government driven agenda. And it's just testament to their drive to create a healthier planet. So incredible group. They're growing. They deserve to grow. They're a major force who are looked upon internationally as being complete leaders in this field of sustainable healthcare.
What kind of role do they have, or what is their main focus in terms of the work that they do?
To me, they have so many work streams, from the NHS Forest, which is obviously all about rewilding, is about planting trees, is about health and well-being, nature walks, all these sorts of things, through to education of staff and education of organisations as well. where they will teach organizations how to do carbon footprinting, etc. So they've got so much more in between. It's hard to keep track of all their activities, but they're certainly the two that stick in my mind as being really, really kind of high profile areas.
It's really exciting that all of this is coming about, and it feels that there is definitely more of a movement towards this being an urgent matter that we need to start disseminating across the NHS as soon as possible. So yeah, amazing that this organisation is playing such a big part in doing that.
Yeah, and we talk to them often. I've now stepped down as a trustee because of Healthcare Ocean, essentially, because as an organisation, we are going to have to work closely with the CSH in future, who have NHS Forest, and we obviously have Healthcare Ocean. There's a great interface there. So as an organisation, we do liaise with them very closely. And as we move forward, especially with our educational programme, we will be building upon the great work they've done with the e-learning for health modules, hopefully even using the characters from those modules as we generate our own education, which will sit alongside theirs. Theirs is obviously very much hospital primary care, land-based, as will be ocean literacy.
Brilliant. I've got some quick fire questions I'd like to ask you.
Oh, gosh.
If you could give one key piece of advice to people about sustainable living, what would it be?
Reduce consumption. Consumption of beef, consumption of products. Stop using the buy it now button. Look at what you can keep in the system. We've just got to reduce our consumption and demand on the biosphere.
What do you wish you knew sooner?
How quickly our oceans were degrading. It was a real wake-up call for me. I knew it was bad. But when I looked at the data from the Global Oceanic Environmental Survey and realised that oceans were probably a more pressing matter than carbon, that was a real low moment for me, because I realised, and this was when Healthcare Ocean was taking shape, it was then I realised that we were rightly focusing on reducing emissions and carbon, but we were missing oceans. And that's when I thought, my God, you know, this is a bigger problem than I realised.
And you personally, I know that you're quite interested in things like scuba diving and water sports. So I can imagine that's another reason the oceans play such a big part to you, because you feel quite, you know, connected to it.
I do. Like I say, from being a child, I've always loved the oceans and ocean wildlife, especially. That's the thing that really gets me. It's phenomenal. It's biodiversity, and it fascinates me, utterly fascinates me. My son has actually become a marine biologist, so he's
taken on that dream for you.
he's followed my dream. But I am a scuba diver. I'm a warm water scuba diver who is now torn between wanting to go scuba diving and not wanting to travel to go scuba diving. So what I've actually done is I've actually shelved all my carbon hobbies. So I used to do a lot of mountain biking, where you had to drive to go riding. So I now no longer mountain bike. I ride from my house. I haven't gone scuba diving in over 3 years. I haven't gone snowboarding in over 4 years because I can't figure out how to do them. And I've got to, I'm not saying we have to put our lives on hold, but I need to figure out how to do these in a way that is not damaging to the environment, because I deep down believe that you do have to walk the walk. You can't be hypocritical.
What will you tell future generations about your role in the climate crisis?
I think that I did something. I took action, and I didn't, you know, I've always been an action-focused person. You've already hinted at bureaucracy that can, and the inertia within systems. We've tried to circumvent this. So the action, what I've done is I've looked at the present system, I've looked at how urgent this is, and I decided that we had to be, certainly within Healthcare Ocean, sector agnostic and outside of the governance of existing bureaucracy. And so we started speaking up, however uncomfortable that was, and started tackling these things really at high level very, very early on. And that's what I did. I found my own voice, and I took that to the very top. And, you know, to be at COP26, 11 months after we formed Healthcare Ocean, you know, speaking in the Blue Zone, the UN Zone, at the invite of the Clean Arctic Alliance and the Monaco Oceanic Health Team, you know, was you know, it really was the Oscars of sustainability, and it was extraordinary. And, you know, I had no idea how I found myself there, but I think it's because we found our own voice, and we used that voice.
Describe to us your vision of a greener world.
Turn the clock back 250 years. Okay, look at what the Earth was doing then. Look at how we consumed. Then plot a path to that world and then envisage how 10 billion people can live in that world without leaving scars. That's what we have to do. And that's what we have to do urgently. We have to turn the clock back on this planet and find a way to live in that new world.
Can the health sector become truly sustainable?
Yes, it can, but not alone. It has to do this through an enormous collaboration. And I think that the power within healthcare is the fact that we have big budgets, big revenues, big buying power, and we do interface with the private sector, as in the suppliers of healthcare goods. And what healthcare does is it gives sustainability a personal voice. And that goes back to what I said about it will threaten the health and well-being of every single one of us, including the billionaires trying to get into space and accelerating the demise of the planet when pursuing their dreams. It would affect everybody. And I think that voice, that healthcare voice and that health voice is so important. And I think making it personal is what will drive change. Health had a loud voice at COP26. We went from one healthcare system declaring net zero to, I think it was 13 or 14 by COP26. 1 year on, Nick Watts, what a journey. What a job they're doing. And it's that voice that will drive sustainability within the health service and beyond.
Thank you so much for your time today, Richard. It's been so, so interesting hearing about the work you're doing. And now I feel I have a much better understanding of the importance of our oceans and waterways and that we need to conserve them at all costs. So it's definitely something I'm going to be thinking a lot more about alongside thinking about green spaces and carbon footprints.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much, Aisling. That's been absolutely lovely to speak. And thank you for being such a wonderful interview.
Ecomedics is a non-profit organisation challenging health professionals and the healthcare industry to recognise the urgency of the climate crisis and to implement change to become sustainable. To stay up to date with our projects and events, and for climate news and sustainability tips, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @eco_medics and sign up to our newsletter using the link below or by heading to newsletter.ecomedics.co.uk. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website, www.ecomedics.co.uk, where you can calculate your carbon footprint, carbon offset your unavoidable emissions, access step-by-step sustainability guides, and buy from our non-profit shop with carefully selected sustainable partners. Ecomedics is run by a team of volunteers, and all proceeds go into the running costs of the organisation. If you want to show your support, you can also donate by heading to buymeacoffee.com/ecomedics. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and don't forget to share this episode with friends and family and on social media. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode. Bye for now.